Honorable, the judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner of form of business before the Honorable of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, I want you to draw nigh and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court.
Is it Rusk? May it please the court. John O'Leary and I were trial counsel in the court below. Mr. O'Leary is seated in the gallery. He was appointed by this court for the appeal. I am appearing pro bono. In my 30-year career as a prosecutor, I learned many things slowly. Early in my career, Magistrate Charlie Gambrill taught me to make sure that the defendant in the courtroom was identified by somebody as the person we were talking about as the perpetrator. Very late in my career, in 2003, Your Honor, Judge Gregory taught me that a mail or wire fraud indictment must include allegations of material false statements, which must not only be alleged, but proved. In this case, Your Honor, please the court, the government changed their theory after the jury was selected, and changed from embezzling from a common carrier, as the victim was not, in fact, a common carrier, to a mail fraud theory. After the jury was selected, they began interviewing witnesses and put their case together. Their theory was that the defendant used his position to obtain, convert money proceeds, profit from his employer. This case comes down to four specific checks, which are found in the joint appendix at pages 821, 822, 823, and 824. These are four checks which were mailed by Baker Transportation to the defendant. This case involves, when you're riding home today on the interstate, look at trailers and see if you see any with the name Extra Lease on them. That is a company we're involved with here. Extra Lease bought in February of 2005 a company called City Capital Trailer Rental. That is part of the confusion in this case. The defendant, Gary Gillian, worked for City Capital. On the side, he created another entity called Capital City. Whether he did that maliciously or not was never established, but it certainly contributed to the confusion in this case, not only by counsel, the court, but customers and clients out there in the marketplace. While working for City Capital, Gary Gillian negotiated a lease with Baker Transportation for 8 trailers. Baker Transportation was an existing client, customer of City Capital. The record reflects that because Mr. Baker was paying late on his leases with City Capital, City Capital was reluctant to lease him any more trailers.
Counsel, do you have an argument about what constitutes a property interest for purposes of the mail fraud statute?
I do, very much. But the government's response to that argument goes back to the formation of this lease in October of 2003. The government's theory is that because Gary Gillian worked for City Capital when this lease was negotiated between Mr. Gillian and Mr. Baker, and then because Mr. Gillian used assets of City Capital to fulfill that lease, the subsequent lease payments belonged to City Capital. We disagree with that theory. Factually, what happened in this case is...
Why do you disagree?
Why?
Yes.
Because these lease payments, these four checks right here, which were the overt acts and the mailings of which Mr. Gillian was convicted, the only four overt acts in the indictment which sustained the court process and the four mailing counts, these were lease payments to Mr. Gillian for trailers that Mr. Gillian owned. Mr. Gillian had purchased those trailers. The government conceded at trial as of December 4 of 2003. He paid cash for those trailers, $2,000 each, a total of $16,000. Mr. Gillian acquired those trailers from his employer and then used those trailers and leased those trailers to Mr. Baker.
You can see that it was a fraudulent scheme to obtain those trailers?
No, sir, I do not.
He grossly undervalued them at the time that he obtained them.
Quite frankly, Judge Wilson, more than likely, there were false statements on the documents regarding the purchase of the equipment. Mr. Gillian did not disclose to his employer that he was in fact the person purchasing those trailers.
The
problem is that the government did not establish that City Capital would not have sold the trailers to Mr. Gillian if they had known he was purchasing them. There was no proof that he had a duty to disclose his identity as the purchaser.
Did he have a duty to sign his to provide his signature on the purchase document?
No, not that I'm aware. No.
Did he? What name did he? What signature did he place on the purchase document? Was it his name?
No. We believe he used the name of a brother-in-law,
James Pitts.
Yeah, you would say that. I suppose your position would be if you went to a store and purchased a car, and I went and I said my name is Joe Brown, but I paid money, that wouldn't be fraud, right?
Well, if you pay cash for the car...
The mere fact that I use a different name doesn't make it fraud, does it?
No.
Right. Go ahead.
If it were fraud, Judge Wilson, the fraud was accomplished when those trailers were purchased.
Well, when you say the...
Gillian paid cash for those trailers.
Yeah, but what... I mean, let's assume the purpose of the argument, the fraud occurred at the time the trailers were acquired.
Okay.
What difference does that make? There was a mailing in furtherance of it in 2006.
No.
Well, there's the evidence of that effect, to that effect. Those four checks.
No, there was no mailing in furtherance of that fraud. That fraud was accomplished when title passed. Title passed in February of 2004.
It's not about title passing. It's about the mail fraud statute. What is title pass? I mean, I know you have centered on this theme about title passing, but you can commit mail fraud in a lot of different ways. I mean, you can have a scheme that can go out over a period of time, and that seems to be what this is, isn't it?
No, sir. There was a scheme. Mr. Gillian was a bad employee. He was cheating his company. He was selling trailers at book value. He was selling trailers at greater than book value, collecting the money from customers, and then paying his company the book value and keeping the profit. That's one group of transactions. Mr. Gillian went to trial as a civil defendant and lost $1 million verdict. Extra took him to trial in a civil case as a bad employee and convinced the jury that he cheated them out of $1 million+. So I'm not here to defend or praise a bad employee. There were other assets. He entered into an extended trailer lease for 250 trailers where he never paid City Capital on that lease. He then turned around and leased those trailers out. He told existing customers of City Capital, you now have to pay me what you were paying City Capital for the rent of your trailers.
I understand what
all that stuff was going on. But these four checks were not part of that scheme.
Excuse me, counsel.
Yes, sir.
Why weren't they part of the scheme? Why wasn't receiving the money back, being paid for the trailers, why isn't that part of the scheme?
Because City Capital didn't own the trailers anymore.
Well, what difference does that make?
That makes all the difference in the world.
I understand your argument.
The other point, Your Honor, is that the government didn't charge Mr. Gillian with any false statement regarding these transactions. That's the point that Judge Gregory taught me in 03, that the government has got to prove a false statement in connection with the fraud. And there are three false statements in this indictment, as I see it. And these are all found on page 74 and 75 of the joint appendix. I'm sorry, page 74. First of all, that Gillian submitted falsified credit approval requests to City Capital. Those were submitted in October 20th of 04, long after this transaction had occurred. Those were submitted in connection with the lease of the 250 trailers. Number two, Mr. Gillian provided false assurances to customers that the two companies were sister organizations. That was done in an email to one customer on March the 9th of 04. Again, long after this transaction was consummated and he had acquired and paid for the trailers, and it's not related, that assurance is not related to this transaction. The third false statement is that Capital City also created false paper trails by taking payments in the form of checks and in return paying City Capital with cashier's checks. That was a different part of the scheme to defraud than this. The government asserted at trial there were three aspects to this scheme to defraud. This was the lease to own part of the scheme. The three false statements alleged in the indictment have nothing to do with the lease to purchase aspect of the scheme to defraud. What happened in this case is the government waited late. Secret Service didn't open this investigation until February of 09. They didn't interview the defendant until March of 2010. By that time, the statute of limitations had already run on everything that he had done as an employee. His employment ended in the end of February of 05. They didn't indict him until August of 2010. The only conduct they had left that they could charge him with was getting these checks from Baker Transportation. So they had to bootstrap it and backdate the whole thing and say, well, when he entered into the lease agreement with Baker, that was fraud because he didn't have the trailers to fulfill that lease. He had to get the trailers from City Capital to fulfill the lease. Because he got them from City Capital, then the profits, which he then was entitled to from leasing those trailers, those profits really belonged to City Capital. What if Gary Gillian had gone down here to Hertz and rented trailers from Hertz to fulfill this lease to Baker? Would Hertz be entitled to those lease payments, the profits from Gillian's lease to Baker, just because Gillian got the trailers from Hertz? I'm here because I earnestly believe that Mr. Gillian did not get justice in the district court below, and he He did a lot of things wrong. He's not a good man. He's been punished civilly. But the government just came up with a theory which, in my opinion, doesn't fit the law. These trailers, or the lease payments resulting from the lease of these trailers, were not property that belonged to City Capital. And more importantly, there are no false statements alleged in the indictment which relate to these transactions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Holliday.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I want to pick up on where Mr. Rushke left off as far as the scheme goes. There are three sort of uncontroverted principles in this case. One is that fraud took place. He admitted that to the district court before we even began trial. He admitted it to the jury during trial, and it's very similar to what he just told you just now. There's no question that Gary Gillian committed fraud against his company. The second one is that when he committed fraud against his company, the City Capital trailer.
You mean he violated his company's policy?
Well,
he didn't give them honest services.
No, sir, I would disagree with that. The honest services.
You disagree that he didn't give them honest services?
Well,
I'm surprised at that.
When we're making a legal distinction between honest services in the sense of McNally and Skilling and all that.
You're trying to make chicken salad without chicken.
No.
Because what you basically then, you're trying to shoehorn an employee-employer situation into a federal case. So my question is, you said he committed fraud?
Yes, sir, he did.
Okay.
He committed
what was the criminal fraud? Not violating his employer's responsibilities, but what is the criminal fraud?
The criminal fraud is squarely within the mail fraud statute.
Okay, go ahead. What was it?
Okay. In October of 2003, when Gary Gillian was an employee of City Capital, he negotiated for a lease purchase agreement with Baker Transportation. That was in October of 2003, using City Capital's property.
This is activity beyond the statute of limitations, right? We started with.
Well, because of the mailings, because of the checks that came in from Baker,
that's the only thing that gets you within the statute of limitations, the mailing, right? The four checks.
The mailings did, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but go ahead.
But the mailings all revert back to the October 2003 lease purchase agreement. They are the fruition of the fraud that he committed in October 2003, but that was carried on out through 2006.
Does it make any difference who he sold them to? Suppose he had sold them to a complete stranger. When I say Baker not being a stranger because of previous customer, suppose he had sold them to a complete stranger to his employer. Would it have been a crime then?
It does not make a difference, and it would still be a crime.
So this would go on for forever, as long as forever.
No, sir, it would.
20 years later, if he sold them, it would be a crime, right?
No, sir, it would not.
Why not? Because the checks would have been within the five-year period when you brought the prosecution. Right?
The fraud took place when he was an employee using City Capital's property.
That was in 2003, correct?
But reaching its fruition all the way out in 2006.
That's what I'm saying. If he had sold them 15 years later to somebody else, it would have been a crime, right?
Fraud. Well, it depends on when the sales transaction took place. If he'd acquired those...
It took place in 2003, you told me.
Well, you were giving me a hypothetical, Your Honor.
Okay.
I mean, if you're saying he sold trailers, whatever. It does matter that the trailers were property of City Capital when the deal was negotiated in October of 2003. The example that I use in the lower court all the time was the car dealer example, where a customer goes to the car dealership and deals with a salesman.
Mm-hmm.
And they reach an agreement that he's going to buy a car on the lot for $30,000. And the salesman himself negotiates that deal and says, okay, you can buy that car for $30,000. The salesman then goes to the owner of the dealership and says, I know somebody that wants to buy that car for $25,000. And he negotiates using forged documents a sales agreement with the owner to sell it for $25,000. And then that salesman goes out and meets with a customer who he'd already made a deal with, consummates a $30,000 deal, and puts $5,000 in his pockets. And the whole time he's doing that, he's an employee of the car dealer. And that's exactly what happened here. He's skimming all these profits that he should have been negotiating for City Capital for himself.
I'm sorry.
Of course
not. I'm finished your sentence, but I do have a question when you come to a logical breaking point.
I think we're pretty much there.
About what the property interest is here, because that's unclear to me.
I'd be glad to clarify, Your Honor. The property interest begins with the trailers. That's the tangible property. However, the payments for the property are...
But he paid for... I'm sorry, you see my question.
I do.
He paid for that property. So what's the company's property interest in those proceeds?
It's... If we look at the Gray case that I've cited, it's the company has the right to manage the disposition of its property and to be sure that its own property won't be used to skim profits that it's entitled to. But, Your Honor, before moving on, the money that comes in the cash is also the property interest of the company because it's intrinsically tied to the value of those trailers and the profits that City Capital should have been realizing from the lease purchase or sale or whatever of those trailers.
And your authority for that second proposition is what?
Case law.
Yeah.
Case law. Well, it's mail fraud under Gray. I could go with Gray, which talks about the company
Gray
has the right
Gray
to
Gray doesn't really get that far, though, does it?
Well, I think that it does because it was part of the jury charges, and it talks about that an entity has the right to control the disposition of its assets, the money that comes in, or whatever. Specific language. Any right that could be assigned to... I'm sorry, that actually goes with the commercial paper in October of 2003.
Yeah, that's why I was wondering. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. But still... Well,
I understand. I completely understand your argument. What I was asking specifically is, you think it flows logically from Gray. I understand that. My question was, do you have any authority for that, what you characterize as a logical extension?
Well, the trailers themselves.
I think maybe your specific... Specific answer is no. You just think it's encompassed within Gray?
Well, I think it's encompassed within the mail fraud statute, and as Gray discusses, I think the trailers actually are more within the four corners of Gray. But I think that we cannot get away from the money that was negotiated, the negotiable instrument that was negotiated in October of 2003, and the payments that flowed from that instrument. In other words,
I understand you.
What negotiable instrument are you talking about?
In October of 2003, when Gillian negotiated with Baker Transportation for this lease purchase agreement that was going to stretch out through 2006, that was for a lease purchase for $16,000. That is an instrument that could be assigned, traded, bought, and sold. In other words, somebody would be willing, if it's $16,000, somebody would be willing to pay a sum of money for that promise to pay from Baker. And that's when I'm referring to a negotiable instrument.
Well, in your hypothetical with the car salesperson, is there any evidence here that they would not have sold that for that price, those trailers, to a stranger? And we know it. What they didn't know was their...
Stranger?
Yeah.
No, Your Honor.
Well, then you don't see in your hypothetical, we know that they would have sold that for $30,000 to that customer. But here, we don't know, there's no evidence that they wouldn't have sold it for the $2,000 per trailer, do we?
Well, it's not the sales price, Your Honor. It's who was buying the trailers.
But that's honest services. No. He was not giving them honest services. We're talking about the property laws here. There's no evidence that they would have sold them. They wouldn't have sold them for $2,000 to someone else.
But the honest services is the predicate step to the mail fraud. When he's concealing his identity, so that the company doesn't know that its own lead salesman is...
He's violating their rules. That's understood. It's undisputed.
That's right, Your Honor. But it goes farther to reach mail fraud because he is depriving them of a property and financial interest.
Right. The deprivation, though, how is it proved when they would have sold that to another person for the same amount?
But it goes to the fact that they wouldn't... When you have your own salesman who is taking your customers, taking your profits... Using your property in a way that you would not have used the property.
So if you violate a compete, there are non-compete clauses in contracts all the time. If you breach that, that's a federal crime now?
if it rises to the level of this, where there's a property or financial interest that the company is being deprived.
It's always a financial interest because it's their potential customers. So you're now turning a breach. Every breach of non-compete clause would be a federal crime because certainly it involves money, potential customers.
Well, Your Honor, even if you go back all the way to McNally and you read the court's decision in McNally and all the progeny that flowed from McNally, they often said that if this had been charged in a way that indicated that the state had been deprived of money or some private entity had been deprived of money, or if you go to the Miller case where the co-op tenants had said we had the expectation that there would not be self-dealing and they deprived us of money, if it had been charged that way, then it would have been mail fraud. It would have fit. The issue is that pre-McNally, the government was under the, well, case law allowed direct honest services to fall under mail fraud, but it changed dramatically in McNally.
Right.
But even McNally acknowledges, had the government charged this in a way that asserted a property loss, then it might have fallen under the mail fraud and it would not have been set aside.
You know that's dicta.
Well, it's informative, though, because the cases that follow from that all talk about that. They say that had this been charged in a way that asserts a property loss rather than just this was a bad employee, then it would not be running afoul of the mail fraud statute because, as the court very well knows, property and financial interests are what?
Suppose he purchased them for $4,000 apiece, way above, and then he leased them for a lower amount to Baker. Would that be a crime?
I'd say it would still be a crime because of the misrepresentation to his, if he did it with forged documents, as he did in this case, it's still a misrepresentation to his company as to who's doing the deal. John Del Canton at trial testified to the fact that had this been found out that we were self-dealing and that we were
a federal crime just because you violate your employer's honest services and violate the.
If there's a property loss, Your Honor, I would say very much it was.
There would be no property loss.
You gave me a hypothetical that if he bought them and then took a huge loss on the.
Oh, you mean the defendant's loss can constitute the loss? Oh, my goodness.
No, Your Honor. Your Honor, I didn't say that.
That's what I said.
But you gave me a hypothetical that I think doesn't make sense.
It may
that
not
he
make
would
sense.
Buy the trailers and then right. sell them for a loss.
It may not make sense, but your response to hypotheticals equally doesn't make any sense because now you're telling me that the defendant's laws can be enough.
I did not say that.
You didn't?
No, sir.
Well, who would be law? Who would have a loss if he paid double the amount?
Well, you would still have the property interest in the trailers themselves, as I was discussing.
They would have released the property interest. That's what an exchange is. If I purchase property from you, you don't have a continuing interest in that.
But, Your Honor, City Capital would not have approved the sale to Gary Gillian had it known Gary Gillian was purchasing the trailers because he was their lead salesman in the region. So that's why he forged these documents. That's why the James Pitts name is on the documents. That's why Kevin Sparks' name is forged. He knew very well he had to conceal his identity and going through with these sales transactions.
Exactly, because he was violating honest services. He had to cover that up.
As a predicate step, but then you get to the fraud because he's depriving his employer of the property that is theirs by acquiring it through subterfuge and using it to line his own pockets.
What Gray and McNally say, though, is that if you deprive an entity over control as to how its property is spent, that's the deprivation that creates the distinction between a monetary fraud and honest services. That it's the right to control how your property is disposed of. So it's not the money. I think your answer in that regard may not be correct. It's the control issue.
I'm sorry if I articulate in a way that was not as clear as I intended it to be, but that was my response to Judge Gregory's hypothetical.
The fraud is absolutely complete.
No, sir. As long as the payments are coming in, it is.
No, the payments have nothing to do with it. You just said you answered Judge Duncan's question. You said that it's the fraud is the depriving them the right to control their property. then it's complete. The fact that because they sold it to him and they had the right to control who they sold it to under that theory.
That's, as I said, I think there are two aspects to the fraud. One is the dispositions of the property, the trailers themselves. And the other one is the profits that flow from those trailers that were negotiated while City Capital still had control of the trailers.
But for that aspect, you got to show some loss. That's a different thing.
But
because that puts you in a statute of limitations problem. If you solely use that line of theory, well, doesn't it? That's why you have to find a loss to put you within the statute.
And there was a loss in this case of over $27,000 just as regarding these trailers. And we did show that.
Haven't shown that the disposition, although they lost control of it, was at a lesser value than they would have sold it to any stranger. That's not.
I don't think that's required, Your Honor, under the mail fraud.
But it doesn't. You get back to the point of trying to show loss.
We have to show a loss in that. I think this will get to it.
Okay.
These were profits that City Capital clearly would have taken and that would have benefited City Capital's bottom line. When the trailers were in the possession of City Capital and Gary Gilliam was negotiating this lease purchase that runs out through 2006, City Capital would have taken that deal and they would have been enriched $27,000 just from this deal alone. So that is the loss to City Capital. It's not that there's some other deal that could have been made that might have been better or worse. It's that City Capital in this instance was deprived of $27,000 intrinsically linked to their trailers because the trailers were the basis of the bargain.
Yeah, but they sold them.
They sold them with a forged document to their own salesman who was taking money from them.
That's what I'm saying. Is there any evidence, though, that they wouldn't have done the same thing for a stranger?
Yeah.
Is there any, follow my question, is there any evidence that they would not have done the same thing for a stranger, sold him for the same price? Is there any evidence in this case that they would, because like in your case, that hypothetical you had, was evidence that, yeah, they had a $30,000 sale, and that's clear. But here, where's the evidence that they wouldn't have sold the same trailer for the same amount of money to a stranger in the case? Not your opinion, but in this record, tell me where that is.
No, there's no evidence they would not have done it with a stranger. But Your Honor, the fact that he was not a stranger makes all the difference.
As to his honest services, you're right. As to violating his employer's regulations, yes, you're correct. But those differences are not enough for the mail fraud. But go ahead. You argue your case.
Well, Your Honor, McNally, as I've already mentioned, even going all the way back to McNally, they did not say if it's honest services accompanied by some property loss or whatever. They didn't say that's out as well. They said if it's purely charged as an honest services case, then it does not survive. We did not charge it purely as an honest. We didn't charge it at all as an honest services case. We charged it a mail fraud case.
Right.
There is an aspect of Gillian's conduct that is honest services, but it goes further and develops into a mail fraud violation because there is a property loss as well.
Who negotiated? Gillian negotiated the agreement?
Yes, ma'am.
To sell?
In October of 2003, but then he also drew up the forged sales documents on December 4th of 2003 and listed John Dale Canton to support him, who was the vice president of the company that gave him cover. Brought John Dale Canton in on December the 6th so that December the 11th, when the sales documents transferring the trailers from City Capital to Capital City reached the vice presidential level, he could sign off of it and get through. Gillian knew it wouldn't get through. And Dale Canton testified at trial that had they been found out, they both would have been fired. But again, I just don't want it to be hung up. There's no doubt that his dealing with his company was not honest. But it does develop into mail fraud and support mail fraud because of the property interest that's at stake. And that's what we charge, and that's what the McNally prosecutors did not. That's what a number of the other prosecutors did not. But we have alleged a property loss and a financial loss to City Capital. And that's why the mail fraud statute's appropriate in this case. That's why it should survive this court's scrutiny. I will be glad if the court had any other questions, but I do think, Judge Gregory, it does matter very much that it was Gary Gillian who was doing all this. It does matter. that it was a person inside the company who was ripping the company off, depriving it of its disposition of its own assets and money that should have gone to its own bottom line. There's no question there's a property interest here. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, in reply, the government relies on the testimony of Del Canton at trial, which appears on page 269 of the joint appendix. The question, and your impression, if anybody else at City Capital had found out about Capital City and the deals that were being done, what would have happened to you? Answer, the two of us both would have been terminated immediately. That's the full extent of the government's response to all the nefarious conduct that Gillian was engaging in. You notice that the indictment alleged a conspiracy to commit mail fraud. This lease with Baker was signed by Gillian on October 28th of 2003. The cashier's check for $16,000 to pay for the trailers was written by Gary Gillian on December the 4th. Under the government's own theory, the conspiracy didn't start until December the 6th. Gary Gillian's wife had died. John Del Canton flew to Columbia from Texas to attend the funeral, and according to Del Canton, they went out for drinks after the funeral, and it was over drinks the two of them discussed how they could cheat City Capital. Interestingly, Del Canton testified at the civil trial that he didn't learn about Gary Gillian's conduct with Capital City Trailers until March of 2004. But viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, the conspiracy begins December the 6th of 2003. Gary Gillian had already entered into this lease with Baker long before he had even discussed anything with John Del Canton.
I'm sorry, I don't understand the point you're making.
The point is that the government put this case together after indictment. They didn't understand this case from the get-go. They didn't indict. If they had charged Gary Gillian with fraud in connection with the acquisition of these trailers in December of 2003, if they had done that within the statute of limitations, he undoubtedly would have pled guilty to that. The government's theory in their closing statement, and this is on page 780 and 81 of the joint appendix, that this was fraud because, first of all, Gillian stole Baker as a customer. The mail fraud statute doesn't protect customers as property. Number two, he deprived City Capital of its right to dispose of its assets. That's going back to the allegation of fraud in connection with the acquisition of these eight trailers in 2003. Assuming that was fraud, and it was never established by any testimony from City Capital that he had a duty to disclose that he was the one purchasing these trailers, that they would not have sold these trailers to him if they had known that he was the one purchasing them. It's just sort of intuitive on the part of the government that City Capital wouldn't have done this if they had known Gary Gillian was the one buying these trailers. But assuming that was fraud, that was completed when the titles passed, which was clearly by February of 2004. The third justification for this is that the money...
Assume that it was completed. What is the point of that? So the fraud was completed at that point.
The statute of limitations.
Well, I mean, but what about the fact, I mean, you can have a fraud scheme where the money comes in at a later time, I mean, and it would extend the statute of limitations. And
if the money were part of the fraud, but the title had passed on the trailers, so subsequent profits.
Well, what difference does it make whether the title had passed? I mean, passing of the title, I mean, what difference does that make?
Who's then entitled to money that flows from those trailers?
Well, the question
the person
is
who owns the trailers.
Not who is entitled to those monies, but whether the receipt of those funds was pursuant to the mail fraud scheme. And when the money comes in, I mean, the fact that the fraud had occurred years before, when the money comes in furtherance of the mail fraud scheme, it extends the statute of limitations to that point in time.
No, Your Honor.
No?
No. City Capital has to be entitled to those lease payments for these mailings to be fraud.
The question is not whether the mailings are fraud, but whether they're pursuant to the mail fraud scheme.
Mailings in furtherance of the scheme, yes, I understand your distinction. But the problem is that there was no longer any property interest in what was generating the checks that were mailed.
Pursuant to
once,
fraud.
Once title passed...
The checks were made pursuant to the fraud. I mean, that was the consequence of... that was the point of the fraud.
What was the fraud here? Who was defrauded?
Well, there's forgery.
So?
And the logical nexus between fraud and forgery is not apparent to you?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I prosecuted fraud and forgery cases for 30 years. I'm intimately familiar with all that stuff. But... assuming there was fraud in connection with the acquisition of the trailers, that's when the fraud ends. City Capital is not entitled to profits that are generated after that fraud was completed. Otherwise, this fraud could continue on. What if this had been a 30-year lease for these trailers? We'd have a 30-year scheme going on here. We've got to parcel out what the fraud is, when it occurs, and when it ends. And any fraud regarding these eight trailers ended when title passed. City Capital gave up their right to collect profits on these trailers by selling the trailers. The third point was that the government contended that the profits should have gone to City Capital. Well, that's only if you can come up with what I would submit would be a constructive trust, which has been rejected as a property interest post-McNally.
Thank you.
We did put in the brief regarding the proffer issue, and quite frankly, I think Mr. Holliday is correct that is going to be very close to a harmless error issue. I put that in myself. I was incensed at all that happened, but we don't need to take up the court's time with that.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. You mentioned the court-appointed counsel was in the court.
Mr. O'Leary.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it on behalf of the court your services. Thank you very much.
I didn't do anything. He drove me up here.
Well, you wouldn't be here without that, and safely.
I would.
And thank you for your pro bono service as well. And, of course, Mr. Holliday's very able representation of the United States. We're going to come down to Greek Council and proceed to our next case.